Okay, this is continuing with Douglas first and now on tape 14. Sulfide
mineral flotation plants. And I went to two people. Notice I got a certain amount of advice, and one was Elmer Tweeter, who was at Dow that was a very important part of their reagent business that will come out in Guy Harris's oral history. But his co-author was Frank McQuiston, who so McQuiston and Tweeter, and that's TVE. TER wrote this, and the way they assembled this chapter, it's really extremely useful. Of all the flotation major sulfide plants back, oh, it would have been late 50s, and the way they made the flow sheet, very, very useful. And the non-metallic, I had somebody I knew from starting with Butte, who was at Armor Chemical Company, was Bob Barson, B-A-A-R-S-O-N. He was quite a good friend of Frank Applin, and his career was with Armor, you know, with the amines and fatty acids, those flotation reagents. I remember visiting there a couple times and used to see him at AIME meetings quite regularly. And then one chapter that I think was truly a major thing was the economics of flotation plants. And for that, I got Norman Weiss and Stan Michelson. Michelson was the chief engineer. Did you ever meet him? Chief engineer of Kennecott in Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. Big man. I mean, you know, great mm-hmm. engineer. I think he's in heaven, but mm-hmm. I know he is. But they wrote about the operating economics, and then they did all of the total capital economics for three scales of plants, like a 5 or 10,000 ton a day mill and a 50,000 ton a day mill. And I mean right down to, you know, the costs of every all the equipment and installation and so on. And, you know, amazingly useful thing. And of course, dated to the time that it was done. If that volume were in print today, it'd be useful with a, you know, engineering index, mm-hmm. Cost index put on it. But and then there ended up a few chapters were not so great. But there were mm-hmm. some of these were just absolutely outstanding and different from the symposium, which took place 1961. And I should have done there are 2-3 papers at the symposium should have been pulled out and put in that book. Mm-hmm. Damn it, it hadn't occurred to me. It did years later that they would have been good additions. But anyway, I did all of this work, and a lot of it was done later. Well, I mean, I worked till 11 o'clock at night after night on the editing of these papers. Mm-hmm. And somebody I'll talk about later, Fred Ravitz, who was a professor here, he did a lot of it. And I know with one of them, he made the comment, I rewrote a lot of it, the authors would be, in this one case, would be embarrassed if we hadn't rewritten it. I mean, would later be embarrassed. then when the thing finally did come out, Spedden told me that they had in the committee of the AME had decided to you know, name me as editor of this volume, which of course I edited that more than any one of these edited volumes you ever saw, including the planning of it. And this is a total aside. One time somebody made the comment, they said it was an Englishman, that they don't acknowledge anybody, this is IMM, I guess, in their public, as an editor unless their name occurs on the outside of the book.
Oh.
In this case, it didn't occur on the outside, and so the Brits don't call me the editor. But now this was paid for by what was called the Rocky Mountain Fund, and see, they...
Here we are. Frost?
We call it Frost Flotation 50th Anniversary Volume, published 1962, and was underwritten by something called the Rocky Mountain Fund. That must have been a endowed fund that AME had.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out they made a lot of money from it, because this, you know, they would underwrite it, but if there's any profit, it goes back to the fund. But see, I'm called the editor, but because it's not on the outside, the Brits don't give me don't give me credit for
it. On the title page, but not on the spine.
Right, right. But see, there's here are all these flow sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this whole business of costs. Mm-hmm. You know, operational, right, you know, what's the cost for the superintendent? Monthly cost, $750 for the superintendent.
Then you, oh, think of that.
For a 500 ton a day mill. Let me see what the monthly for 10,000 superintendent, 6,000 for 10,000 ton a day mill.
Well,
so that's getting a little bit
very
better.
Good.
So superintendents, so...
Mm-hmm.
That means probably foreman and everything else, right?
That's right.
But the point is, you know, they go right down
really
into very detailed costs per day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Part two. Then that's the economic. I mean, that's a capitalist. That's what Stan Michelson did.
How do things go? Okay. Yeah, I had it right. Okay.
You probably, I hope Jocklick told you a little bit about Michelson. You know, he's really, in an indirect way, responsible for the breakup of Kennicott. You'd never really say that in a direct way, but he was just an outstanding engineer, and they were getting, you know, the power consumption there at Bingham is obviously huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he said, well, why don't we buy a small coal mine there in Carbon County, somewhere in Utah, so that if the electric company ever gives us trouble, I suppose Utah Power and Light, we have our own coal mine that we can generate our own power. So they bought this little coal mine, I assume it was not a huge coal mine, and that was the end of it. And whether they mined it or sold the coal, I don't know. It was Sven who told me the thing. Well, anyway, when they bought Peabody Coal, then that came out as, they were a victim of antitrust. You know, they had to spin off the coal. Well, it's because Stan Michelson had suggested and urged them to buy this coal mine so that they would have their own power in case Utah Power and Light gave them trouble. Anyway, Michelson was the guy that ran all of the engineering and design and so on.
He became vice president or president of Kennicott, didn't he?
No, that was...
There were two Michaels.
Hey, I'll tell you, and I never did meet the one that you're thinking about. There was Big Mike and Little Mike,
mm-hmm.
and Stan Michelson was Little Mike, and Big Mike was the person who came up from Braden, I guess, Braden Founders. And C.B. Michelson was his initial. I never met him.
Okay.
And I think he was just, I don't think he was probably like executive vice president or that sort of level, because Millikan was president for a long, long time. And so I think C.D. Michelson never became president, but I bet he was the number two man to... Did you ever meet Millikan?
No.
I did once. He was a long time. That was another thing that of AIME activity got started during my time there. Another AIME thing took place in 57, which is kind of a nice little story. There's something called a Robert Lansing Hardy Gold Medal, and this award was established to recognize the most outstanding metallurgist under the age of 30 in the United States. Professor Hardy was who I saw somehow later, was actually did his PhD here at Berkeley, was a physics prof, had an office next door to Gaudin, and his son was a metallurgist, and at age 25, only son, I guess, had a brain tumor or stroke and died. And the father was, Professor Hardy was very distressed and wanted to do something with the insurance. And so Gaudin said, well, why don't you establish an award to recognize a young metallurgist? And so Gaudin I guess helped work out what the details would be. And so within the AIME, and now it's done through the Metallurgical Society, is this Robert Lansing Hardy Gold Medal Award. And it turns out I was the first recipient. And looking back on it, it's really the only award that I got that came through Gaudin. I mean, all the other stuff, he already left this earth. But I, my guess is, I'm the first recipient. In fact, it says 1956. So in 1957, I was given this award, and it was given that time at the Niagara, what they call Niagara Frontier section of AIME. And I remember I gave a talk, and I got those pictures around here somewhere while they're at home of getting this award. And in this case, it was a 1 ounce piece of gold, nice metal, and today I think by definition it's gold plated, right?
Undoubtedly.
Oh yeah, I know very well, because we're probably talking about an original endowment maybe of $5,000, I think, and so that, of course, could make a $35 gold medal. I remember when I, the day after I got that, one of the laborers, kind of a funny guy, by funny I mean humorous, that worked for me in the pilot plant there at Carbide, his first name was Jim, I don't remember his last name, and he said, well, that metal and a dime will get your beer anywhere. Which is Rich, of course, would tell you about the price of a beer then, but he put it in the right perspective. So that was a nice occasion that I never had any idea about. And so just through the years, I've seen the list of who's been a recipient of this. We have four faculty members in our department are the recipient. There have been several.
Is it given every year?
It's one a year, but and the person cannot, you've got to be still 29 by the time the annual AIME is. And I was on the committee for 4 years, and one of the times during that period, Craig Barrett got the award. He was then at Stanford, and you know, he's now chairman of Intel. He makes a paper every other day. He's an academic who decided he wanted to get into the real world some years ago and moved up to being, as I say, he makes a paper quite regularly. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's been one other processing person that got the award, which was my own, I must have had something to do with it by definition, former student of mine, John Herbst. And other than that, they've all been, more or less what one would call physical metallurgist or materials property type people. But I'll just throw out something that happened during the time that when one is on a committee like that that has age and other restrictions. One year, I suggested that that I would vote for him, that he's the better person, but he's only 28, he has another year of eligibility, and if the rest of the committee goes with that, give it to this other person. And that's the way it went. And one shouldn't do that, because the next year could have been a super, super nomination that would beat out the one who should have gotten it. So I made it, made a kind of a mental note that
changed your mind on that.
And by the way, the person who did get it a year later, whose field was fracture mechanics, was at that point, I'll look up the name, was a assistant professor, I think then at Stanford. He then went to UCLA, and he was flying down to, and he either informed or was a big part of something called Failure Analysis Company, and he was just flying from LA down to San Diego to work on some problem related to an airplane crash. And he was on that PSA jet that when the plane hit it, landing in San Diego and killed everybody, a few years ago. And he was on, age 44, he was on that airplane and somebody was practice landing with a cloth over the windshield, right by at the San Diego Airport as this PSA jet was coming in. And it collided, it was a big, that was one of the big major wrecks, 20 years ago or less. Anyway, I've seen this list of the, hardy recipients of really quite an outstanding list.
Good club to belong to.
And I was the number one person. And then about, by the time there were 16, 17 people, it occurred to me that we have this gold medal that you got to having the bank, and I suggested to the AIME that they also give out a certificate, which hangs on the wall. Well, anyway, they went to Hardy, the father, and he agreed. So they then made all the certificates, and I think 1 year they mailed out six, you know, in Tom Hennery's signature, I guess Tom Henry was president of TMS then, the same Tom Henry we talked about earlier, and you know, they should have had a nicer, you know, at the AME dinner, they could have just had all 16 old ones come and receive. It would have made kind of an interesting affair, but instead they mailed them out. Now they, of course, give everybody the certificate and the, I think what is the gold-plated medal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I sort of told you about
we might have reached
carbide and
a good stopping point.
Oh yeah, that's just what I was going to say.
We're inserting just a little bit to back.
Vibrating ball mills. In Buffalo, there was a cement plant in Buffalo that Elvis Chalmers had put in at roughly that time, a 42-inch vibratory ball mill. That was a big commercial unit. But the energy was so intense that the balls came through the shell.
Ooh.
And they, period, end of report, no more effort on going into the vibrating ball mill business.
No.
You just couldn't do it at that. But apparently they did, a 42-inch one would have been a huge affair. And I guess the wear was very, very bad. And so that never became a production facility. But they're nice for laboratories. And in Germany, I think they use them for, but they're made sort of racks of them that might be a foot diameter and 6 feet long and maybe four of them in an assembly. So an individual isn't big, but they use maybe pigment grinding, things like that. But Alice Chalmers' device never got off the wall because of what I just said. But we had this 15-inch one in the laboratory.
Okay.